And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Fine Music 102.5. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and with me in the studio today is Ken Thompson.
Hi, Bill, and hi to everybody listening.
And our special guest today is Robert Hoag. Robert is a journalist, a speechwriter, and an author. He has two books. They're about ugly. The second one, which was released only in August this year, is subtitled A Butte Story About One Very Ugly Kid. Robert has made his name as a former speechwriter and advisor to the Queensland Premier Anna Bligh, and he has numerous short stories published in Australia and overseas. But we're going to be talking today about his memoir, Ugly, and what it's like growing up, as he describes himself, as ugly and disabled. Robert, welcome to the program.
G'day, Bill. G'day, Ken.
Hey, Robert.
So, Robert, you strike me as a glass half full sort of guy.
Indeed.
What did you want to achieve by bringing out the second book, the special children's book?
Bill, when I was born with some massive facial deformities and two deformed legs, and I've got two artificial legs now, so I told my story in an adult version of my memoir that came out a couple of years ago. And one of the great things that happened after that was I got to talk to lots and lots of school kids. And it was just amazing how much school kids wanted to talk about appearance, about being different, and about being disabled, and how we talk about all of those things. So I thought it was a great opportunity to actually write a book for them. The adult version has, you know, I'm a pretty simple bloke and I'm a pretty simple writer, and I think the adult version's pretty accessible, but it also has, you know, chapters on the underarm bowling incident in 1981 and chapter on politics in Queensland in the late 1980s, early 1990s, which aren't much interest, which aren't of much interest to your average 11-year-old. So it was just a chance to write a book in language they understand and in a way that was really engaging to them.
Yes, you stop at grade 10 in the new book. So you don't go on to what happened to you yourself later in life and some of the good and bad things that have happened since then.
Indeed. So I think, you know, one of the things about a children's book is obviously it's a bit shorter, and I decided to focus on my life story from when I was born, but primarily going through school and some of the issues I faced and confronted during school, being a kid who was pretty different.
Yes. When did you first realise that you were different?
I think probably in grade one. I remember, you know, I had when I was born, I had a massive tumour in the middle of my face that came about during my development, and it kind of subsumed my nose and pushed my eyes to the side of my head like a fish. I also had two deformed legs, as I mentioned, and I had some operations to correct my facial deformities, move my eyes to the front of my head, but I still didn't look like a treat. And you know, kids when we're out swimming, my dad would take me swimming all the time, and, you know, it's hard to hide away when you're in the middle of a pool swimming, and kids would say, oh, well, what happened to your face, or why have you got a squashed nose, or where are your legs? So kind of by the time I was four or five, I got a sense that I was a bit different from most kids. But when you get to school, you realise those things very, very quickly if you haven't already. So by the time I got to school, I was kind of reminded regularly about exactly how different I was.
That's, I guess, when the nicknames started, which would have perhaps brought it home even more.
Yeah, I think probably by the time I accumulated a bunch of nicknames. I'd get kind of a new one every 6 months or so, and some would fall out of fashion. But by the time I was in about grade eight, Bill, I had probably 10 or a dozen nicknames. You know, so some common and not very nice ones, and you know, some ones that were you know, about my artificial legs. But I started to get some nicknames pretty early.
Sometimes that's a sign of popularity, but I know one of them at least wasn't very complimentary.
Well, I think, you know, in the book, in the children's book, I'm really open and honest about that because I think kids want to understand it and want to hear about it and want to talk about it. And so I just put a list of, 10 of the nicknames and what they meant to me and where they came from. And there were some ones like I got called toothpick legs because people used to think my prosthetic legs were made out of wood. They're mostly metal these days, which is good because they're a lot lighter. They used to be fiberglass, which was pretty heavy, but, I got around, which was fine. And I did have some that I actually liked. I used to get called Transformer, like the old cartoon and the toys you used to get where the robots would turn into a car. And, when you're a young boy and you get called Transformer, that's pretty cool sometimes. But also there was one in particular that referred to some work I had done in one of my operations when I was very young. After doctors removed this tumour that was in the middle of my face, I was left essentially with a flat face, no nose. So when I was 4 and a half, doctors were doing a big operation to move my eyes back to the front of my head and build me a new nose. Now, they had to build my new nose out of something, and they were amputating my right leg at the time so I could wear two prosthetics. And so they used a couple of toes off my right foot to build me a new nose, which was, it still astounds me. It strikes me as quite weird, but, as a genuine medical marvel. And I still have no idea exactly how one crafts a nose out of a toe, but they did it. But, of course, some kids found out that had happened. And so one of the nicknames I got, and the one I hated the most and still find quite confronting, is Toe Nose. Kids used to pick on me and, say, well, you've got a nose made out of a toe. And the thing about that was it kind of made me ashamed of the really good work the doctors had done. And as far as I can tell, your nose is, you need a nose for precisely two things, to smell through, which I can do, and to hold up glasses or sunglasses, which I can also do. Other than that, they don't serve a lot of function. So the doctors did a pretty good job.
You mentioned about being open and honest, and that is an absolute feature of this book. And you've also been open and honest about your parents' attitude. And I think your mother kept a diary with all her feelings. Did she have any problems, or was she, or perhaps, oh no, in fact, she passed away about 10 years ago. So did she know you had a project in mind to write all this and to put her thoughts into this book?
Funny, she and I used to argue while she was alive about who should write a book, whether it should be her or whether it should be me. And I actually think she would have told a wonderful story, and indeed she did tell a really good story in a diary she kept. I spend a lot of time talking to kids about that because these days mums get scans when they're pregnant. But I was born in the early 1970s, and I was the fifth of the fifth kid that my parents had. Now, I'm not going to call my brothers and sisters who came before me normal, but they were certainly healthy. And so, my parents were pretty simple working class folk, and when I arrived, they had every right to expect a perfectly healthy baby, and they had no inclination whatsoever before I was born that I was going to be anything other than perfectly healthy. So I was born, and I was actually taken away from my mother before she even saw me, and it took her like a week before she came and saw me. And then as soon as she saw me, she kind of shut down and said, well, I don't want to take this baby home. And then there was a lot of conversations, a lot of back and forth, a lot of kind of consideration about what the impact of bringing me home might have on my brothers and sisters. And eventually, about a month after I was born, Mum and Dad decided to bring me home. And my parents, but particularly Mum, was really honest about that. And people ask me my feelings about that. What does it feel like that your mum didn't want to see you for a week and then didn't want to bring you home? And I kind of like, well, I think too often we pretend that all of our emotions are immediately positive, and anyone who ever suffers any negative emotions, like, anger, despair, crankiness, being upset that there's something wrong with them, and we immediately need to get people to a happy place. I actually think for parents who are expecting child and didn't get that, I kind of understand that roller coaster of emotion that they must have been going through. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book was I hope it's a good story and I hope kids enjoy it. But I also think if it can help other parents who've got kids who have some kind of difference understand their emotions a bit better, then that's done a really good job as well.
Yes, I think it must be a great relief for other parents to see how your mother Mary, how she reacted when confronted with this type of situation.
Yeah, well, I think it's just, there's a whole range of human emotions, and maybe people would get straight to acceptance and understanding, but not everyone would, and not everyone necessarily should. And I kind of think we ought to just cut people some slack while they're trying to work through their feelings and process something that's happened to them that is quite shocking.
We're speaking with Robert Hogue, a journalist, speechwriter and author of a new book for children, actually, called Ugly, a Butte Story About One Very Ugly Kid. We're going to take a short break now, and we're going to play a song by the Beatles called In My Life. And that was In My Life by the Beatles, and we're speaking with Robert Hogue, journalist, speechwriter and author of the new book Ugly, a Butte Story About One Very Ugly Kid. So Robert, we were just talking about the reaction of your parents. You've since discovered that the reason for your disability was that your mother, you think, was on antidepressants, and you had that discussion with her. It must have been a very difficult conversation.
Yeah, and I think, she was on antidepressants before she knew she was pregnant, and they stopped, but the best explanation for my deformities are those drugs she was on. And I kind of think, I don't blame anyone for that. My parents had the opportunity to sue the drug company, and they chose not to do that. And then when I turned an adult, I had the opportunity to sue them, and I chose not to do that either. I think, we all get dealt some bad hands in life, and some of those hands really suck, and it's really tough for a lot of people. How we deal with those things, the kind of attitude we take in dealing with them, can go a long way to defining us. my parents were always quite pragmatic and quite realistic, and they said, well, Robert, you've got a disability and you've got some facial deformities and it's going to have a bit of an impact on your life, but it's going to define part of your life, but it doesn't have to define all of your life. It needs to be in context, and it's going to mean, you know, you're never going to dig ditches for a living. My dad was a mower man and a wood chopper and cut cane one summer, and I was never going to earn a living doing that, but I just had to get on with it.
Yes, your parents seem to have different ways of dealing with the stares and whispers that they undoubtedly confronted. I like the story of the way your father dealt with it.
As I mentioned before, we'd often be at the pool swimming. My mother was particularly scared of water, so she wouldn't take us swimming too much. But Dad would take us to the pool all the time and get in the water with us. So I lived in Brisbane. I lived down near the water, so it was always a good opportunity, particularly in a hot summer, to get down to the pool or get down to the beach. And often kids would stare, and sometimes my dad would ignore it. But there was this one time where one kid was staring at me and asking some questions. You know, Dad was within earshot, and he yelled out the kid. It's like, "Oi! You get lost. Your mother wants you." And this kid looked at him and he was like, "Oh, my mother's dead." And Dad, without missing a beat, said, "Oh, well, it must be your father then." Poor kid. Like, poor kid's just being curious and asking me some questions. But that was, you know, that was just Dad's kind of way of protecting me.
And I guess that love that came with you from your parents as you grew up has given you the confidence and the drive to be where you are today.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, without a doubt. Had a bit of time thinking before they brought me home about what impact bringing me home might mean on my brothers and sisters and on their lives, and it took them a while. But when I came home, I came home to a wonderful and loving family.
And that's a really good story too, when they had to make that decision, the family conference.
Family conference. All of my parents decided to sit my siblings around our kitchen table, you know, where all important family decisions are made. And my siblings were aged from 10 to 4. And my parents talked about me and what impact bringing me home might have on the family. And they decided that they'd let the kids have a vote. So one by one, oldest to youngest, they asked my brothers and sisters, should we bring Robert home? And one by one, thankfully, they all said yes. My sister Catherine, who was only 4 at the time, reckons the only reason she said yes was because everyone else said yes before her. So I tell kids, maybe peer pressure's okay sometimes.
So it was a unanimous vote, that's the good thing.
Yes, indeed.
So apart from having those prosthetic legs and a face that looked a bit strange, what generally was it like growing up as a child?
Oh, I think it was... I had a great childhood. I mean, I couldn't run, I couldn't jump, I had to get used to new artificial legs whenever I grew into a new pair. And you know, I had kids who picked on me a bit at school. I had a very good childhood. I had lots of friends. You know, I came from a family of 5, so I was used to giving as good as I got. And I had great parents. And I think probably the thing I owe my parents most is that they equipped me with an understanding that my appearance and my disability would play a big part in my life, but didn't have to define all of it. And it was up to me as a person to define it. And that includes making peace with how I look and my disability and working out how I talked about that and how I dealt with the issues that arose from it, but how I kind of positively incorporated that into my kind of worldview and how I talked about myself and how I behaved rather than it confining me or defining me, if that makes sense.
And there were a couple of very good episodes. I remember one was when you confronted David on the steps, and another one was when you were in hospital and you got that card from grade 1. They must have lifted your spirits enormously, I imagine.
Yeah, Yeah, I'll tell you about my friend David. He was just this great kid I met in grade one. Our grade one classrooms were down a long flight of stairs, probably about, 25 steps. And I had two artificial legs, and my mum was a bit worried about me going up and down the stairs. And so first day, she escorted me to school, and it was fine. Then second day, she escorted me to school and stayed at the top of the stairs because I said, "Mum, I can do it." And I held on to the railing to make sure I didn't fall over. And I was going, headed down the stairs. But then halfway coming up, there was this other kid who was holding onto the railing as well. And it's like, well, I've either got to move over to the side because if I walk down the middle of the steps, I might fall. When I reached him, he just stopped and grabbed my hand and took my bag and took me all the way downstairs and helped me down. And it was just really lovely. And I think I had lots of great experiences like that as well.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's certainly the good side. And then the story of your the running race when I think you kept up with them for the first step.
But then, if that, yes.
But by the end of the race, everyone was watching you and no one even knew who'd actually won the race, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was so funny. We had sports carnival at our primary school, as most schools do. And the school insisted that I go in the race despite not having any legs. And my kind of mum and dad argued about that for a bit. Dad was a bit worried that, putting me in the race might make a bit of a spectacle of me. But mum said to him, well, he's got to see what he can and can't do, and he should be given the opportunity to compete along with the others and see what happens. And so off I went in the race, and the gun went, and yep, I probably kept up for, two or three steps, but by, the first 10 metres, I was well behind, and I was probably still, in a 100 metres race, I was probably still at 30, 40 metres, less than halfway by the time everyone else was close to finishing. And I fell over and picked myself up and kept going, and then fell over again and picked myself up and kept going. But at that stage, I had lots of people cheering me on and willing me to do well. And it was really important to me because it was kind of fun to compete, even though I knew I wasn't going to win. It was just fun to be part of things. And I think there's, often there's a tendency to exclude people with disability or difference because we're worried that including them will emphasise how different they are. But I think a lot of people with disability know that, and it's great when we can give them the opportunity to be included.
And it's certainly given you a lot of stories to talk about, Robert.
But yes, indeed.
We'll have to move on. We asked you if you'd like to pick a song to go out on. I wonder if you could tell us which one you picked and why you picked it.
Gambler by Kenny Rogers, and ostensibly it's a song about death, but it's also, I think, really about life and being really realistic and having a positive approach to how you handle life and how you deal with things.
You and your family have both taken a number of gambles along the way, so I think it's very appropriate. This is The Gambler by Kenny Rogers.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness till boredom overtook us. And he began to speak. He said, "Son, I've made a life out of reading people's faces and knowing what the cards were by the way they held their eyes. So if you don't mind my saying, I can see you're out of aces. For a taste of your whiskey, I'll give you some advice." So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, and his face lost all expression. Said, "If you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. Every gambler knows that the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing what to keep. 'Cause every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser, and the best that you can hope for is to die in your sleep. And when he finished speaking, he turned back toward the window, crushed out his cigarette, faded off to sleep. And somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold 'em. Know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. Sitting at the table, there'll be time enough to count when the deal is done.
And that was The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. So if you go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, we'll be in touch. And if you'd like to listen to this show again with our special guest, Robert Hoag, you can go to the website. So it just remains for me to particularly thank Robert Hoag, the author of Ugly, a Butte story about one very ugly kid. Thank you, Robert, for being on the program.
Thanks so much.
It's been great talking to you. And so we'll be back next week with another show. But in the meantime, that's it from Dads on the Air.